Welcome to The Capital Connection, a weekly conversation on New York State government and politics. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for The Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's The Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. This week, it's columnist and Albany bureau chief for the New York Daily News, Ken Lovett. Hey, Ken, you've been up night after night sitting in the hall while three men, the same three positions, sit in the room. Two of them on the way to the pokey, but Andrew Cuomo stays there. But there are some things, I think, that never change. He says a lot, and then after he says it, it doesn't always happen the way he said he wants it to happen, which leads people to, I know I'm talking a lot, but which leads people to suspect that he doesn't really want it to happen. Let's take the minimum wage, for example. What do you know?
Well, I think in this case in particular, this is called the art of compromise. It's convoluted, it's tricky, but the reality was he went up against the Senate Republican conference that really did not want to deal with a $15 minimum wage. They felt it was arbitrary, they felt it was too high, but it was the governor's top priority. So they had to come away with a deal that he could at least claim he got to 15, and they can claim they fought him back. So what it looks like is that New York City will get to $15 over 3 years. Right now it's $9. They'll get to 15 an hour over 3 years. Unless you have a business with 10 or fewer employees, then it would be 4 years. On Long Island in Westchester County, it would increase to 15 an hour over 6 years, and that would be reviewed in the middle after 3 years to see if it's hurting the economy or not, and then the governor could make alterations of the legislature. And then upstate, it would take 5 years to get to $12.50 an hour, and then after that, they would tie it to any increases to inflation on a yearly basis until it got to 15. So upstate, it could take a while to get to 15. Certainly Long Island and Westchester, we're looking at 6 years, potentially even longer if the economy turns, and then New York City, either 3 or 4 years, depending on the size of the business.
Well, there are a couple of ways we could go right now. One of them is to quote his late father, Mario Cuomo, who said something, I'm sure I'll murder the Polish, which is Shnash Nunu Bab, which means in that time a new pope could be born, meaning he gets the victory. But as you suggest, all kinds of other people could come along and say, no, this isn't working. We're going to change this. We're not going to really make it. In the meantime, he's competing with California, who really is thinking about a genuine $15 an hour mandatory amount.
Well, and the governor will argue, I am sure, and he's already started to make the argument, is that we want to pull people up. We want them to make a livable wage, but we can't do it at the expense of businesses if they can't afford it. So he'll say this is a prudent approach. Obviously, this is a watered-down version of what he wanted to do. He really could not walk away without anything because that would be a huge political black eye. I mean, he named the effort after his father. So, I mean, for him to walk away with nothing would have been unacceptable to him. So, in the end, he gets this kind of weird, situation where minimum wages are going to be rising at different rates in different communities and over different times.
Hey, Ken, love it. It sounds like a lot of hooey to me. But I want to talk to you about an ancillary issue. We know the New York State Senate is up for grabs, right?
Yes.
And we know that this governor has always said, I'm for the Democrats taking it back. But most of us suspect he's full of baloney, that he doesn't want it, that they act as a brake when the Assembly Democrats want too much, that he doesn't have to take the pressure for it. And right now, true to form, he's not even campaigning actively for the Senate Democrats who have a chance of winning out there. Is that right?
Well, he endorsed Todd Kominski, but that's what he tends to always do. He'll endorse the Democratic candidate, and then the question is, what else will he do? Will he help raise money? Will he actually go out in areas exactly where he's popular and try to win it for them? So far, he has not done that. The feeling is that he was using that as leverage over the Republicans in these negotiations, that if I don't get minimum wage, if I don't get paid family leave, I am going to come into your district, into that district on Long Island, the Dean Skelos seat that There's a special election on April 19th, and I'm going to campaign hard against it. Now that he gets his deal, the big question is, did he cut a deal that says, hey, you know, give me what I want or something like it, and I will leave you guys alone? And that's what we're going to see over the next couple of weeks. It's easy to speculate that he won't do these things. He won't campaign for the Democrats. But obviously, over the next 3 weeks, we're going to see for sure, because he either does or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, yeah, it really sends a message for going into the fall when the real battle begins for control of the Senate.
But I'm arguing with you that he has so much clout now, because if the Democrats are in, the Republicans are out. And if the Republicans are out, no matter whether they're one vote short or five votes short or whatever, they still have the power of warm spit, and they know it. They don't want to lose their majority. So you would think that he had an awful lot of clout. You say it's the art of compromise. Yeah, but where does the line get drawn?
You know, sometimes, and I remember this with pension reform, so-called pension reform, in his first year, sometimes even he can't deliver something that, you know, or it's a real heavy lift. This is not an easy lift with the Senate Republicans. They really fought this. This basically became a civil war within the conference of the Republicans. Upstate really did not want it at all. And Long Island, they could handle it, and they knew it would become a campaign issue. So a lot of them said, let's get something, even if it's not 15, but we need to be able to say we did something. And, you know, they've been working on this for weeks, and the reality was the Republicans have had a hard time signing off on it. They're being threatened by businesses. They're being threatened by the Conservative Party. They're being threatened by their base. And so, you know, he can threaten all he wants the governor, but there are other things in play as well. And I think this was a really heavy lift. He used a lot of political capital. John Flanagan, the Senate Majority Leader, used a lot of political capital, and that's where we're at now.
Well, you know, there are a lot of barking dogs around all of this.
Yes, I'm sorry about that.
Don't be sorry. We all have barking dogs. We should point out that we've gotten you very early in the morning, as you've been up all night covering these budget things, and we couldn't ask for more than that. Okay, so Ken Lovett, let's go back to de Blasio, my favorite subject with you. I believe this is the new, nicer version of Andrew Cuomo. And that ever since the Preet Bharara, you know, implication that he might get indicted and then he wasn't indicted, I get the feeling that we have a different Andrew Cuomo, and that he is pulled in his horns with a lot of things. And I want to get to that, but I want to ask you specifically about his relationship with the mayor, de Blasio. Do you sense it's getting any better?
No, I don't think it's getting better at all. I don't think it's as openly hostile right now. I think they've agreed to tamp down the tensions publicly. But one only has to look at some of the stuff the governor was proposing in the budget that would have harmed New York City. Part of it was because the governor has this self-imposed mandate to keep state spending under 2%, you know, the increases under 2%, and he needed to find money. But his budget sought to push $485 million in CUNY funding, of state CUNY funding, city university funding, onto the city. It would have been a $500 million expense. He sought to put about $180 million in extra Medicaid funding onto the city that the state's now covering. And these became huge issues for the Assembly Democrats to fight over during the budget negotiations.
Well, there are a lot of places to go here, but I want to remind everybody you're listening to Capital Connection. This week, it's columnist and Albany Bureau Chief for the New York Daily News, Ken Lovett. Hey, Ken, before we go any further, that's interesting because I have a new thesis. I wrote a column about it. There are people who say I'm wrong. Some say I'm right, which is that sometimes he waits to get to that spot where that sweet spot where he ought to be and ought to have been from the very beginning. So he puts on the table, as you say, the CUNY basic reduction. He denies he's even doing a reduction. But they get crazy. The professors at CUNY, I'm getting all kinds of calls. There are cartoons of him with a draconian teeth with blood dripping from his teeth. And all of a sudden, it goes away. He says, okay, I'm not going to do that. Isn't he kind of silly to put these things on the table and then to withdraw them? Doesn't it make him look, he doesn't get a lot of people who are going to love him for it. The SUNY professors that I know, I mean, the CUNY professors, City University of New York professors aren't going to love him at this stage of the game. They think he's their enemy.
Well, the reality is he snuck all these things into the budget. You know, he had been focused on housing and homeless issues and all these things publicly, and it really wasn't until the budget came out. And frankly, we our coverage of it in the Daily News, the day he announced the budget, our front page was these cost shifts. And if I recall, my lead of the story was the spat between the governor and the mayor is now getting costly for the city. Because he was really looking to shift over about $800 million or more in costs to the city. I think that was out of anger. You know, I think there were two things involved there. One was he really did want to stick it to the mayor. He's not a fan, and he wanted to really send a message. And the other, and I think it's equally valid, was, again, you know, he wants to hold state spending increases to 2%. And to do that, you have to maintain costs. But he has a lot of spending initiatives in this budget. So what did he try to do? He tried to offload about almost $1 billion, $800 million, onto the city, which, you know, that would have been money the state saved, and he would have it would have made it easier to keep under that 2% cap. In the end, he's promising that, well, we'll get $250 million in Medicaid savings, much of that coming from the city. And he's also looking for, quote-unquote, efficiencies and savings from SUNY and CUNY. So he's looking to save the money because, again, he wants to stay under the cap. But he because of the Assembly Democrats, it's not going to be as harmful to the city as it certainly could have been.
Well, you know, that's a very interesting point you just bring up, because CUNY became the subject of this whole thing. He was going to cost shift, as you say, and take the money basically away from CUNY. The City University was going to have to put the money in themselves. Now, one of his greatest allies has always been Nancy Zimpfer, the chancellor of SUNY, State University System. But now, all of a sudden, he's talking about cost savings at SUNY. That's got to scare the hell out of her, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it does. And you know, back office savings. I mean, I'm sure they've spoken, and we're going to see over the next year. They say they're going to come up with a plan to try and consolidate different operations between CUNY and SUNY and try and do other things. We'll see how it works. But certainly he's looking for that. I'm sure SUNY's not too happy about it.
Well, here's Nancy Zimpfer, a terrific chancellor, really great. And she has been really helping him in every way. He comes up with this plan that businesses that affiliate themselves with a SUNY campus will have tax breaks and all kinds of things like that. She does whatever he wants. Now, thank you very much, Chancellor Zimpfer. Now I'm going to really hurt you.
Well, is it a surprise that you know, Andrew Cuomo will do what is best for Andrew Cuomo? I mean, you know, I think he is working with them. My guess is in the end, CUNY will find a lot, you know, face a lot tougher questions than SUNY will, because for whatever reason, he's not a big fan of CUNY right now. And so my guess is a lot of this cost savings that they find is going to have to come out of CUNY, more so than SUNY, because like you said, he has a very good relationship with the chancellor.
Well, I'm sure that the people at SUNY are shaking a little bit. And there will be those who say serves them right for cooperating with this guy as much as they have. But I'm a big fan of the chancellor. I think she knows what she's been doing up until now. But he may have drawn a sort of line in the sand in which somebody's got to say no to him.
Well, what's been really weird is, like, you know, his reasoning behind all this. It's evolved in everything. So you take the CUNY funding that, you know, he wants to shift. Originally, we report, you know, he wants to shift $485 million. That first day when I asked about it, their response, the Cuomo's response was, well, CUNY has a third of the board members. They should pay a third of the operating costs. You know, they stopped paying toward operating costs during the fiscal crisis of the 1970s, but now they're doing better, and they should pay. So we run our story with that logic. The next morning, he takes a lot of heat, and it becomes a different answer, and it evolved into, well, we want to find efficiencies and savings, and then it evolved even more. So, I mean, you know, the reasoning behind it has never been clear because it's evolved, and we saw that with the Medicaid as well. It went from being we want efficiencies and savings to, you know, the original response was, well, you know, because what the plan is the state picks up all Medicaid cost increases each year now for the counties in New York City. So when he decided to make this change, the only one he would have eliminated that provision for was New York City. And he argued, well, the counties are all under the property tax cap. New York City isn't, so they should have to pay their share. When that didn't work, he then went, well, we want to find efficiencies within the system and we'll work with the city. So it's always evolving. There's never one straight answer on it.
But I really do love the chutzpah, the ingenuity of saying they've got a third of the board members are appointed by the city, so they should take a third cut. I mean, that is really unbelievable.
Yeah, but that lasted about a day.
Yeah, but why?
That one won't fly.
But why do you come up with something that's that stupid, frankly? I mean, that people aren't going to like. Hey, look, here's an interesting fact. We know that when Zephyr Teachout, who had no money, she was to the left of center, far left, ran against him in the Democratic primary. She won almost every single upstate county. Now, what saved them was New York City and Long Island. My question to you is, when you attack the City University of New York and Medicaid, which is health insurance for poor people, basically, and older people, aren't you really asking for trouble politically?
No, honestly, I think he's banking on the idea that paid family leave, you know, they have agreed to a 12-week paid family leave program, a statewide paid family leave program, and the minimum wage increase in New York City will offset those. Because in the end, those other cuts did not happen for CUNY and the Medicaid program. So I think in the end, he's banking that people will like the progressive programs he's putting in place, which was what this budget was supposed to be for him.
Okay, very quickly, Ken, because we're running out of time. I always love having Ken Lovett of the Daily News with us because he's the best of the best. Okay, here we go. What happens now to the Independent Democratic Conference under Klein, Jeff Klein from the Bronx, who have made peace with the Republicans and done a coalition with the Republicans? I've always suspected that the day Andrew Cuomo says to Klein, you know, you got to go back with the regular Democrats. You've said before that they'll keep their conference, but they will do business. They'll caucus for the purposes of organization should the Democrats win. Are you sticking with that story?
I am. I think if they had their druthers, they would like to stick with the Republicans. I think they feel more comfortable. They have better relationships with the Republicans. But I think politically they know if the Democrats take it, they cannot deny the Democrats the majority a second time. You know, the Democrats had a numerical majority a couple of years ago. And because the IDC, you know, aligned themselves with the Republicans, they weren't in power of the Democrats. I think that would be fatal this time. Also, given where the governor is heading, now this can always change, but the governor obviously has had a much more liberal agenda the last year. And I think what you're going to see is he may not need the Senate Republicans as much anymore. There's going to be things he does like them, but he'll use the independent Democrats to kind of play the role of the Republicans. When he needs things blocked that he wants to propose but not really do, he'll have the IDC block it.
Well, you're much better at this than I, but I got to say, I don't agree with you. And here's why. I truly don't think when he says he wants something, he necessarily means it. Remember, he ran for office for the first time as a so-called Clinton conservative. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of tax caps and things like that. Then he gets the life scared out of him by Zephyr Teachout, who I mentioned, who runs against him in a primary. And he looks behind him. He says, oh, my God, the left isn't, they don't love me. I'm not Mario. And he starts to do all this stuff. But does he mean all this stuff? I don't know, and I suspect he doesn't.
But we're in agreement on this in the sense that what I'm saying is he needs to at least look like he's catering to the left. But when there's issues that he doesn't want to get passed right now, you know, the Republicans block it, he says, well, I tried, blame the Republicans.
Exactly.
But what he'll do is if the independent Democrats who are more conservative get together with the regular Democrats, he'll use the independent Democrats like he's using the Republicans. So he'll tell Klein, look, you know, I'm putting this out there. You guys don't like it. Just block it. And then he'll blame the IDC. He'll use the IDC in a similar manner that he's using the Republicans.
Ken Lovett, there are five Republicans who are lining up to run against him. Do any of them, in your considered political estimation, have a prayer?
I think it's going to, I think the Republicans have a deeper bench than I've seen in a long time. It's still New York, which is an issue. And if he runs for reelection, I think as we speak right now, he could be challenged. I mean, if you have the right candidate, certainly upstate and the suburbs are up for grabs. And that, and you know, if the Democrats aren't really hardcore for him and aren't coming out in droves, we saw a million less people vote for him the last time. Then there's an outside chance. There is a chance. It's an uphill battle for sure. But I think, look, a guy like Chris Gibson, I think, would be a great general, a congressman from the Hudson Valley, who's retiring from Congress this year, would be a great general election candidate, but he would probably have a hard time winning the primary. A guy like Harry Wilson, who ran against Tom DiNapoli for comptroller in 2010, and did a lot better than a lot of people expected. He almost won. I think that would be a solid candidate.
Well, he almost, to be fair, he almost won only because Cuomo was sticking it to DiNapoli at the time. Now he's not doing that
anymore. No, sure. But you know, if Cuomo is weakened, you know, perhaps he would have a shot. It's all going to depend on, can someone raise money, enough money, which has been a problem, and can they can they reach out to the independent Democrats and the independents, you know, who aren't enrolled in a party? Because right now what we've seen with Rob Astorino and Carl Paladino 4 years before that is they won the primaries and then they got the nomination, but they only brought out the base of the party. They didn't, like, cross over. And the Republicans, in order to win, need to get some of the more conservative Democrats, and they need to get some of the independents. Okay. They have to have crossover appeal.
That's great, Ken. We have 2 minutes and 30 seconds. I want to ask you real quickly. Clinton versus Sanders in the primary in New York State. What are the polls showing? What's likely to happen?
A Quinnipiac poll came out on Thursday morning that was actually a little surprising. It had Hillary Clinton ahead by double digits, but by only 12 points. I think it was something like 54-42 54-42. I was surprised. I thought she'd be ahead by more in New York. I think it's going to be interesting. And don't forget, this is not a winner-take-all state. No. Basically, New York has what amounts to 27 separate primaries. It's based on congressional districts. And you have to win each congressional district, and that's how the delegates are apportioned. So, you know, she is lucky she has the superdelegates, and she has a lot of support with that. Without it, I think this would be a really competitive race.
You know, Bernie has surprised people before. You know, there's a sort of a left hardcore that really believes he's right about everything he's saying. I happen to believe he's right about a good deal of what he says, too. And I'm a big Hillary Clinton fan, but people could go with him.
I think you're seeing that. I mean, he's really resonating. Perhaps the Clintons knew what the poll was going to say, or their own polling is showing it, because they've had a lot of surrogates coming out this week in New York saying, you know, I'm a superdelegate, I'm not switching. You know, they're making it clear that she still has the support. And, you know, if Bernie Sanders can't pry away the superdelegates, it's going to be Hillary Clinton's nomination.
Well, it's always wonderful to talk to Ken Lovett. He's the best columnist in Albany. He's the best political reporter in Albany. He's the bureau chief for the New York Daily News. And no matter how tired you are, Ken, you keep coming back. It's time to let the dogs out.
Well, thank you. This was fun. It always is.
Thank you, Ken.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.